Do you suffer from insomnia? Does your significant other frequently comment on your endless snoring? And how many times have you thought to yourself, I'd feel so much better if I could just get a little more sleep? Well, tonight we hope to offer a little insight on just how to do that, and we hope you'll actually not sleep, but stay awake for this, too. I'm Kermit Poling, and on tonight's Health Matters, I'm joined by Dr. Andrew Chesson, professor of neurology and founder of the LSU Health Science Center's Sleep Disorders Clinic. That's actually a mouthful. We'll be taking your calls, so if you'd like to get in on tonight's program, call us at 800-552-8502. Again, our number, 800-552-8502. Dr. Chesson, thanks for joining us this evening. And sounds like we've got a little extra audio in there that hopefully that'll go away. How many different types of sleep disorders are there?
Well, there are a large number. There now is the International Classification of Sleep Disorders, which is some 300 pages listing the types and variety of sleep disorders that are out there.
So I think the one that most of us generally think of primarily is insomnia. So what is insomnia, and then what are the other disorders that there are?
Well, insomnia is the difficulty of falling asleep. And sometimes that relates to difficulty going to sleep, sometimes that relates to difficulty staying asleep, and sometimes it relates to awakening too early. Mm-hmm. So things that give you trouble getting to sleep, staying asleep, are generally considered insomnia. There are a huge number of other types of sleep disorders. There are breathing disorders in sleep. There are a group of disorders we call parasomnias. Para meaning about, somnia meaning sleep. So things that happen in and around sleep that are either normal variations or abnormal variations, such as sleepwalking and sleep talking and rarer behaviors such as exploding head syndrome and a variety of other types of
things. Oh, no, exploding head syndrome. You've got to explain that. Someone's head doesn't actually blow
No,
up.
It doesn't actually explode. But it sounds from within side like it's exploding. Okay. There are a variety of disorders that do abnormal movements mm-hmm. in sleep, where either people can't move or they have excessive movements or they have painful movements is another common variety of disorders.
That seems to sound like it's related to, if I'm not sure, it's called restless leg syndrome. Is that one of those?
Restless leg syndrome is one of those. Restless leg syndrome has to do with a symptom. The patient is aware that they have difficulty being still. They have the urge to move. They're uncomfortable unless they're moving. There are others that the patient isn't aware of at all because they're asleep, and I sometimes wind up arbitrating disputes in my office between he said, she said kinds of things. You do that. No, I don't. Yes, I do. And it's not in our usual range of thinking that we do major unusual things and aren't aware of it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes that happens during sleep.
Are any of these sleep disorders considered particularly dangerous?
Well, certainly there are. I've had people come in who've dived out of second-story windows and gone through plate glass doors and wound up in the middle of a strange neighborhood in the middle of the night in types of dress that were not things that they would have chosen to wear out in public, much less in unusual places in the middle of the night. Wound up in hotel lobbies, wrapped in the draperies that they were able to locate in the hall to try to get back into rooms.
So they don't know that they've done this, but there's some level of I don't know, in thinking going on somewhere that they've gotten that far.
Yes, yeah.
But they're not aware.
They're not aware. Or there's this difficulty with the boundaries between wake and sleep, where they rapidly oscillate between those so that they are performing but not truly aware of their activity.
I'm speaking with Dr. Andrew Chesson, who is the professor of neurology. He's the founder of the LSU Health Science Center's Sleep Disorders Clinic. Why don't you talk a little bit about the clinic? Let me give the number one more time. As you're storing up your questions, you can give us a call here at 800-552-8502. 552-8502. We'll welcome your question this evening. So what is the Sleep Disorders Clinic, and I mean, what do you do? Who do you see?
Well, a lot of times people aren't aware of things that are in their hometown, but we have a very unique situation. We are the only clinic in the state of Louisiana that has two components, both a national accreditation for the center itself and the ability to train sleep doctors in an approved sleep fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been there for a long time. I started getting interested in sleep in around 1980. And at the time our center here was accredited, there was less than one center per state in the United States that was accredited.
Let me ask you, because you said that's about the time when you started getting interested in sleep. What was it about the subject that grabbed your interest?
It's a multidisciplinary specialty. It involves people in neurology and pulmonary and psychiatry and internal medicine, endocrine. And to be good at it, you have to be interested in a whole lot of different things. And one of the successes we've had is that we have a multidisciplinary team. In our clinic, people that are boarded in sleep medicine represent additionally boarded in neurology and psychiatry and pulmonary and internal medicine. And so I enjoy the aspect of discovering what it is that a third of us spend our lives doing that we don't understand. We don't really know the fundamental purposes of sleep and what sleep do. We know that it contributes to memory. We know that it contributes to healing. We know that it contributes to health. But how it does that, we're still working to understand.
So part of what you do at the center is study these.
Right.
And you also, in the process, are treating people as well, right?
Correct. We have a research program, and I've been very actively involved with the National Association for Sleep. I've been president for the Academy of Sleep Medicine, have written a number of the guidelines for treatment of sleep in North America.
Okay. Well, we have our first caller here.
Good.
Remember, if you would like to call us this evening with a question about sleep, that's the subject tonight, 800-552-8502. Here's Bob in Shreveport. Bob, thanks for joining us this evening. What's your question?
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm really calling on behalf of my wife, who has what to me seems to be a strange sleeping disorder, in that if we're watching TV together anytime after 8 or 9 o'clock, she immediately goes to sleep, and so we shut down, go to bed, and she absolutely cannot go to sleep. So she has to get back up, watch TV, and then has some success sleeping in front of the TV. I'll listen to your response.
Okay.
There are several things that could be related. One is there are some disorders, such as sleep apnea, where when people are in bed and they're lying down, they may have some trouble with breathing, typically tend to be loud snorers, and the sitting up position actually has some physiological reason that they would tend to be more comfortable with their breathing and be able to get into deeper sleep. Another thing that we see not uncommonly, and it fits in the category of insomnia, has to do with people who have learned behaviors that the bed and the bedroom are alerting experiences for them. They often have had trouble with going to sleep. They essentially do battle with sleep. They struggle, they try, and that activates the autonomic nervous system, which we learned back in high school and college is the fight or flight system. And that works against sleep. And so they're sort of like, simplistically, rats in a maze. They've learned to be awakened by the sleeping, the usual sleeping environment. And there are things that we can do to try to sort that out and to help them.
I guess that makes me think that there are so many people that that I can think of, and I guess I'm included in there as well. You know, I'll tend to fall asleep, say, you know, in the living room. Maybe I've been watching TV, maybe not, but I'm in a chair, you know, not necessarily in bed. And yet I find, and I usually think to myself, well, you know, because I slept there, now I'm, you know, I've got enough sleep that I don't really want to, you know, I can't really get to sleep when I'm back in my bed. But it could actually be more that, you know, it's the trigger of the bedroom, like you're saying. It's something different.
And now, if you've been sleeping for a period of time, so you've had a substantial nap, then your body may not be ready to go to sleep when you get back to the bedroom area. And that sometimes can be an experience as well.
Sure. That would be nice. I don't get much time for that, unfortunately. We do have another call that's coming in. Again, our number is 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. I'm speaking with Dr. Andrew Chesson, and he's a professor of neurology. He's the founder of the LSU Health Science Center's Sleep Disorders Clinic. And we have Virginia, who's in her car in stop-and-go traffic, evidently, in Kilgore, Texas. Virginia, go ahead with your question. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I have a question. Do you ever see cataplexy where someone would be on the floor, it appears they're passed out, but they're still conscious, still hearing, unable to open their eyes without narcolepsy?
No. Generally, cataplexy itself, which is a problem with loss of muscle control, for other listeners who may not be aware of that, let me back up just a minute. The normal part of dreaming sleep, called REM sleep, the body is paralyzed. That's what keeps us from acting out our dreams. There are disorders where that switch can be misaligned, and the switch to paralyze the body can happen independently of falling asleep. That generally is called cataplexy. Where it happens most of the time is in a constellation of diseases called narcolepsy. And that includes not only cataplexy, but excessive sleepiness, some tendency not to be able to move when you awaken, and a few other features. So independent of narcolepsy, I'm not aware of that, and I would look for some other diagnoses. We occasionally will see people with narcolepsy who the presenting symptom will be cataplexy, and with a more careful evaluation, we can come up with an appropriate diagnosis.
Okay, we are on our first caller from South Arkansas this evening. This is Alan in El Dorado. Alan, good evening to you. What's your question?
Hi, I have a question about restless leg syndrome. By all the descriptions I've read, believe I have that, and I've tried several medications, and they either don't do anything or give me really bad hangovers the next day. Wonder if there's anything else I can try for restless leg syndrome.
Well, Alan, there are a number of things. It's a disease that I've been very interested in, and I actually wrote the initial guidelines for the treatment of restless legs in North America for the Academy of Sleep Medicine on a committee that I was involved in. There are some now very good medicines that typically will get reasonable control of restless legs. The problem is that there's a lot of art to the use of those medicines as opposed to pure science. The timing of them, the way we do the dosing, and sometimes combining them in a way that we use one to help the body be ready for another, are all part of what really helps us be able to control it. Additionally, there are some disorders that make make restless legs much harder to control. One is unusually a certain binder with iron in the body. You don't have to be iron deficient, but for that binder to be absent, it gives us a great deal of difficulty fully treating patients. The other is that there are a variety of other medicines that actually considerably worsen restless leg syndrome. And those medicines will make it very difficult to treat. The medicines that treat by causing people to be sedated don't really resolve the problem. They just tend to cover it up and often do carry over into the daytime.
All right, we have another question, this time from Mary Ann in DeRidder. Welcome to the program, and what's your question tonight?
Yes, I work with patients, a great majority of them have post-concussive syndrome or mild to moderate traumatic brain injury, and we've noticed a high incidence of sleep apnea among that population. Have you seen that within your clinic?
Well, sleep apnea has become a very common disorder, perhaps 5% of males over 40. Women tend to get it a little bit later in life, but 4 or 5% of females postmenopausal tend to have it. So now that we're looking for it, it is a common disorder. Now, having said that, things that interfere with brain function can worsen the tendency to have apnea. Problems with airway control, problems with swallowing, some things that may go along with traumatic brain injuries can cause worsening tendency to have sleep apnea. And probably the most common problem nowadays is the fact of being overweight often is a contributing factor to sleep apnea. And sometimes people in that category who no longer are able to exercise like they did before and so forth and are gaining weight will be thrown into the apnea category.
Our number 1-800-552-8502. You can call with your question about sleep and sleep disorders this evening. Again, our number 800-552-8502. What's the connection with sleep difficulty, I guess sleep apnea specifically, and snoring?
Snoring is an indication that you have a narrow airway. The muscles of the airway are what we call dilator or opener muscles, and they hold the airway open. When you go to sleep, those muscles relax just like the arms and legs and everything else. So the airway is at the narrowest during sleep. If it is relaxed and narrow and you suck air past it, it'll create turbulence. And that makes snoring. The airway is a sound chamber. That's how little bitty vibrations of the vocal cords get to be talking and shouting and singing. So if it's vibrating, the PA system is on and it turns into snoring. After you go past that and the airway becomes floppy, particularly with additional fat or tonsils or adenoids or those kinds of things, then it sucks shut. And that closing of the airway is what causes apnea.
So for that period of time, you're not breathing.
You're not breathing. You're not oxygenating. That's one of the reasons that apnea can be a serious medical problem.
All right. We have another caller. Again, our number, 800-552-8502. We have Mary Catherine in Shreveport. Good evening to you, and go ahead with your question.
Hello. This is wonderful. I've got really two questions, and pick one to address if you like, or both if you can. One, I had heard that it's better sleep-wise for the brain if you go to sleep by 11 o'clock at night. I don't know if it has to do with circadian rhythms or not, or if it's some other type of rhythm. Perhaps you could address that. And also that, what is the relationship about carbohydrates and sleep? Is there one?
Well, the first one, people do have circadian rhythms, and you go to sleep best when your body temperature is falling. Your body prepares you to go to sleep according to your circadian rhythm. So if you are a morning person or an evening person, you may have a slightly different circadian cycle. So typically when people get up, if they aren't in bed by 11, unless they're late risers, they're going to have sleep insufficiency. And so that may be a trigger. Once you get past a particular circadian timing, you may actually have more trouble going to sleep individually than if you agree with your circadian timing. The carbohydrate issue, there's a lot of stuff going on right now that we are beginning to explore. There is an issue now that people may actually become more obese if they sleep less. There's also some issues that fragmented or disrupted sleep may interfere with insulin secretion, have an increased tendency to create diabetes. And we haven't understood that very well, but now there's some new evidence that sleep actually regulates some of the hormones that control hunger and tell you when you're full. And it also probably has something to do with insulin control. And so loss of sleep, either voluntary loss of sleep because you got more things to do, or medical loss of sleep where things are interfering with your sleep, may create a cycle that promote more trouble by causing apnea, by causing other medical conditions. And I can sort of piggyback on that and say that one of the most common sleep disorders now is societal sleep insufficiency. 10 years ago, I never used to ask people about whether they text at night or whether their telephones are on and what they're watching on their computer and so forth. Now that we're a 24-hour society, there's a huge tendency to think that sleep is dispensable. And we believe that not to be true.
All right. We're getting our next caller here. This is Leslie in Shreveport. Thank you for calling this evening. And what's your question?
My question is about sleep paralysis. I've been dealing with it for well over 10 years, but I never really had a name for what I was experiencing until I finally found some other people who were experiencing the same symptoms as me. What can you tell me about the causes of sleep paralysis and also the treatments?
Well, Leslie, it's a very interesting condition, and I'm sort of fascinated by it. Typically, when I give my lecture to the medical students on that topic, one or more of them come up afterwards and say, well, I've had that. And it actually is a fairly frequent problem that we experience once maybe or twice in life. For the other listeners, what that is the fact that essentially you wake up, your brain wakes up, but your body remains paralyzed. Remember I said that in REM sleep, a normal part of that is that your body is paralyzed to keep you from acting out your dreams. Normally, the switch removes everything at once. Sometimes it doesn't remove the paralysis. There are some medicines that have been used to treat that. There are actually some tricks that we can teach patients to help them break those episodes. There are conditions where it's part of another disorder, and there are conditions where it's an independent problem. It also runs in some families. There's a familial sleep paralysis. So you might inquire to see if it's something that families don't often talk about or recognize because they don't know what it is. But it sometimes can be familial. It's a benign condition generally, but sometimes it's problematic enough that that we can make either behavioral or medication changes to fix it.
Okay, we have some more people that are holding. We'll get to your calls as soon as we can. 800-552-8502 if you have a question about sleep or sleep disorders this evening. This is a call from Minden. Seth, good evening to you, and go ahead with your question.
Yes, since I was about 7 years old, I've been having lots of trouble falling asleep at night. Normally, I'll only be able to fall asleep after 2 or 3 in the morning. So I've, for a very long time, had 6, maybe even 4 hours of sleep a night. Before this started happening, I was on a drug called phenobarbital for a couple of seizures I had when I was an infant. And I was wondering if there was any correlation between phenobarbital or any other kinds of medication that could cause or contribute to some sort of sleep disorder.
There are complex interactions between medical conditions, sleep, and medicines. Seizures can sometimes in themselves disrupt sleep, but phenobarbital is a sedative, and sometimes withdrawal of phenobarbital can cause problems with sleep. Sometimes in childhood, when people begin to develop problems, whatever the difficulty is, over time they will disrupt their circadian rhythm. And so the initial problem sometimes can be resolved, but the continuing factors have to do with the body's change in circadian rhythm. And it's often hard to do that. Now, we have some good procedural programs to correct circadian rhythm deficiencies, but it isn't easy to do. People often will recognize themselves that they have that problem, but it's not a simple fix. We're designed to protect our circadian rhythms. A mom with sick kids who has to get up at night doesn't want to have disruptions of her circadian rhythm, so they're resistant to change, and we get into bad ones, and they're also resistant to change.
You're listening to Health Matters this evening. I'm Kermit Poling. I'm joined by Dr. Andrew Chesson, who is the founder of the LSU Health Science Center Sleep Disorders Clinic. And of course, obviously, as you've been hearing, we are discussing sleep and sleep disorders. And our next caller is Beverly in Shreveport. Good evening to you. Go ahead with your question. Hello? Go ahead.
Hello?
Go ahead. You'll probably want to turn down your radio first.
Yes. Yeah, and has had it.
Go ahead with your question.
He's had it since before when he weighed more, but he's on blood pressure medication, and he has lost 30-something pounds. He still continues to have the sleep apnea, so he continues on the breathing machine at night. Is there any hope for him being able to get rid of the apnea or get, you know, doing away with the breathing machine?
Yes, there may be. I would have to know a little bit more about the situation to try to customize it. But the nature of the narrowing sometimes is apnea. Sometimes it's structural, tonsils, adenoids, a long palate. The dangly thing in the back of the throat called the uvula can get in the way. And if those, and the nose can be a problem, polyps, nasal restrictions. So sometimes fixing one or more of those can be an alternative to the CPAP machine, which is the breathing machine that the caller describes. I would need to know a little bit more about the underlying problem to try to directly answer that question. But there are surgical treatments, there are device treatments, not only CPAP, but there are also some oral dental appliances that we can use, as well as weight loss.
Which was going to be my next question, because you're talking about treating sleep apnea, and these are all used, different treatments that
right.
You can use for that. We have, Vina, I guess. Okay. Thanks, Rick. Vina in Ruston, who is calling with the question. Go ahead this evening.
Okay. Forgive me if it's already been asked, because I missed a little teeny bit of the show.
Well, go ahead.
I would like for you to address sleep apnea and memory loss, because I know that when somebody's having memory loss, one of the first things doctors do is have them tested for sleep apnea.
Yes. Memory dysfunction is a potential problem with sleep apnea. To make a complicated story sort of simple, one of the things that we believe that good sleep does is to consolidate and formulate memory. Part of the reason that infants sleep prolonged periods of time compared to adults is to try to develop their neural pathways. The additional factor is that apnea often results in drops in oxygen. If you're not breathing, you're not oxygenating your brain. And so if that's sufficient, that also can interfere with memory and thought processes. Lastly, sleep deprivation itself. A bad apneic may wake up hundreds of times during the course of the night, even though they're not aware of it, because by the time they're awake, the airway has been fixed. So, again, it's another sleep disorder. The person may be entirely unaware of the consequences. That fragmentation of sleep in itself may result in impairment of memory.
How long does it take to treat?
It can be very short. If somebody uses a CPAP device, within days they can be feeling better. If it's a surgical option, then, you know, there's got to be a recovery period. If it's weight loss, it depends on how quick.
But if they're using the machine, do they have to use it, forever?
Somebody who has apnea, unless we fix the underlying problem, using the machine does not fix the anatomy, the physiology. It just corrects it while the CPAP device essentially puts some pressure in the airway and splints it open.
Mm-hmm.
So the airway is open for you to breathe. If you take that device away, then the next night you'll go back to having the airway close. So it's not a permanent solution in itself. It is a time-buying solution that we can work on other things. And it's a good way to quickly fix the problem.
You had touched on, and I think maybe it was restless leg and perhaps it running in families. Are there a lot of sleep disorders that are genetic or seem to be genetic?
There are. Restless legs is one of them. There's another one we call periodic limb movements of sleep, which are various leg movements that occur in sleep in sort of a rhythmic type of manner. Those can run in families. There is sometimes a tendency for insomnia to run in families. Now, whether that has to do with learned behaviors or whether it's some gene we're going to figure out is the cause of insomnia, that still remains to be seen. We believe at this point that sleep apnea is probably not a genetic disorder in itself, but sometimes the airway can be genetically predetermined. Just like people have little noses and big noses and little ears and big ears, they can have big airways and small airways. And the more you have a tendency to have a small airway, the more little things can interfere with that airway being open. So that can be a problem.
Less than half a show to go this evening, so if you'd like to get your call in about sleeps or sleep disorders, here's the number again, 800-552-8502. Again, 800-552-8502. Go ahead.
One of the things that you led out with had to do with the insomnia, and that's an area where many sleep centers don't really have an active program. And we all treat people with insomnia. There's a tendency to give them a pill to try to make them better. One of the things that we are developing now, we have a new faculty member who's joined us from Pittsburgh, who is a psychiatrist by previous training before he got his sleep boards, and a specialist in insomnia. And we're beginning to develop some additional insomnia programs that we've not had as readily available before. There's some new evidence-based medicine that a technique called cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a taught technique, probably is much more robust as a long-term treatment for insomnia than sleeping pills. And we're beginning to set up groups to use that as another clinic modality that we're doing, partly because we need to teach our sleep fellows who are training to be sleep doctors those techniques, and partly because there's no other area to get that in this region.
Sure. Well, one of the things I was going to ask you, and that relates to that, because you mentioned, you know, sleeping pills and all of that. If someone is having an insomnia problem, is it more likely to hinder them or help them if they do, you know, I think you see all the advertisements on television, and, you know, this will help you sleep, that'll help you sleep, you know, is that an okay thing to try, or is it more likely to cause problems later?
As a permanent treatment by itself, it's rarely a long-term effective treatment. It usually creates a tendency to dependence on sleeping pills and so forth. So as a window or a guide to what's going on and to try to use it as a comprehensive treatment program, it can be very beneficial. Mm-hmm. You have to determine what kinds of sleeping pills are useful for the specific type of insomnia that you're trying to treat if you're going to be successful as well. One pill doesn't fit all.
Okay, makes sense. We have Lisa in Haughton. Lisa, thanks for calling this evening. What's your question?
Hi, I have a family member that often wakes up in the middle of the night and eats and usually doesn't remember. I was wondering what might cause that behavior and if there are treatment options for that.
Sure. That falls into the general group of treatments that we call the general group of problems that we call parasomnias. And it's now been determined that almost all of our basic drives can occur in altered form in sleep. So sleep movements, sleep eating, hope it's okay to say on the radio, but even sleep sex, all those kinds of activities can occur in an altered way during sleep. And there are two types of nocturnal sleep eating. One has to do with a variant essentially of sleepwalking, where the person actually does it in their sleep. Another has to do with waking up at night with sort of a ravenous appetite. And so first we have to sort of sort out what category they're in, and then we can figure out what the appropriate treatment would be for that condition.
So if someone is actually still asleep and doing this as opposed to waking up and being ravenous, what is that, and what how would you treat that?
Well, that's typically kind of a sleepwalking variation. Mm-hmm. And we would first make sure that there aren't things that are fragmenting their sleep, because fragmented sleep makes people more likely to do that. So we would do an evaluation for that. We'd also try to keep a diary and look for patterns and so forth. I've had people go and eat lard-covered styrofoam and all sorts of weird and unusual, non-usual foods in that kind of setting. Once we know the stage of sleep that it occurs in, then we can try to affect that with medications.
Okay. Our number tonight, 1-800-552-8502, 1-800-552-8502. And we have another caller. I'm not sure. Do we have a caller holding or not? Rick will have to let me know. I think this is John in Marshall, Texas. John, go ahead with your call.
Yes, this doesn't happen every night, but maybe two times a week. Right before I go to sleep, sometimes I feel like I'm falling, but it's like my whole body jerks, and it wakes me up. Sometimes, you know, just my legs jerk. I'll hang up and listen for the answer on the air. Thank you.
Okay, John. I think a lot of callers can probably identify with that. That's something, the fancy doctor name is called hypnic jerks. And we believe it is a change in the brain patterns. Waking brain is a more desynchronized, where lots of different areas of the brain are doing different things, and the waveforms are different. Sleeping brains tend to be much more synchronized. And I tell my patients that it's kind of like the jump to hyperspace. All of a sudden the brain synchronizes, and the area of the brain that synchronizes often will give off a discharge. And if it's a motor area, there'll be a jerk. Sometimes I see patients who come in who have a blinding flash or a bolt of lightning in their head or a loud noise. Probably it's the same phenomenon, but involved with the part of the brain that controls hearing or the part of the brain that controls vision. It is generally and it usually happens typically when people are going to sleep or waking and then going back to sleep in that transition period where it's kind of jumping towards sleep.
Next up, we have Michelle in Hallsville. Go ahead with your question this evening.
Hi, my husband has severe apnea. He's been through a sleep study, and it is caused by a deviated septum from a broken nose when he was younger. Our insurance company will not pay for the surgery if the CPAP works. And I'm just wondering if this is something you've run into before, because like you said before, the CPAP is not a solution. It's just a patch. And wondering what we could do to possibly fight this decision.
Well, we occasionally run into that. And typically what's worked for us is careful documentation about the anatomy problem, the likelihood that they will fix it with treatment, in that case, such as fixing the septum. And we make an argument for them that actually it's cost-effective for them to get the septum fixed as opposed to a lifetime use of CPAP. And generally, we've had relatively good success being in an accredited sleep center and being able to talk to them about those kinds of issues.
All right. Next caller on Health Matters this evening is Bill in Houston. Bill, thanks for calling. And what's your question?
I may have just missed it when I was holding, but I'm a CPAP user. And earlier you mentioned CPAP being something you would buy time with. Is there known long-term negative effects of using CPAPs? Is the CPAP the final answer for some people?
Certainly, Bill. Yes, it is. And we have a lot of people who are on long-term CPAP. I've had people, I guess, now on it for some 20 or more years. There seem to be very few side effects to the use of CPAP, which is one of the reasons people tend to use it as opposed to going through surgery, which may or may not work, or being motivated enough to address weight loss. CPAP is a much easier to use device now than it was when we first started. It was a device that was a 2-foot square box and heavy, and there were only, originally when we first got started, you had to glue the mask on every night. Now there are a whole lot of different interfaces. There are connections that are just like nasal prongs like you'd use for oxygen. There are a variety of types of masks. And people feel so much better when they're rested and when they're able to function that the fact that they just put something on just when they're asleep at night and they sleep so much better than without it, it's a perfect solution for many people.
Aside from the weight loss aspect of treating sleep apnea, are there other aspects of diet that just help by nature of the food? You know, we hear that, you know, turkey is supposed to help you sleep, or at least it seems to on Thanksgiving.
Sure. Well, and in fact, Grandma's right about a lot of those things now by science. Turkey has an agent in it called tryptophan, and tryptophan is actually a sleep-promoting agent. And so warm milk and turkey and some of those kind of things may actually be effective. One of the erroneous related things is that alcohol helps people sleep. Alcohol, in fact, may give as a relaxant some people, particularly who are nervous or anxious or worrying about things, the ability to get to sleep. Typically during the night, alcohol is a sleep disruptive agent as the levels fall. So some of those solutions aren't as good as they're cracked up to be as well.
All right, our next caller from Jefferson, Texas. This is Stella. Stella, good evening to you. What's your question?
I have a question about the effects of Ambien. I have had a very recent experience with a person who has been taking Ambien and was having some very distinct memory loss of that activity that he got up in the middle of the night and conducted. And just wondering if it's a common side effect of Ambien, or if you have any information on that.
Well, Stella, I wouldn't say that it's a common side effect because there are tons of Ambien used out there. But there is a reported phenomenon of an increased tendency to do behaviors in sleep that people don't recall with the use of Ambien. Sort of a sleepwalking kind of a component. And whether it has to do with the fact that people are more deeply asleep and they are not aroused by usual things, or whether it has to do with promoting whatever mechanism promotes sleepwalking that we don't fully understand, still is up in the air. That has been reported with other agents as well. And there is some memory loss associated with some types of sleeping pill. Generally, the rule is that the shorter the acting sleeping pill, the more tendency there is for some retrograde amnesia or loss of memory occurrence that may occur with that.
1-800-552-8502. Still time to get in on this evening's program. We got about 15 minutes left or so. We have Lee in Jacksonville, Texas, holding. Lee, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Well, for quite a long time, my wife was woke all night. She had this restless leg syndrome, they call it, and she couldn't sleep. And then we saw in our Jacksonville paper here a column by Dr. Gott, and he gives advice on different things, and he said about putting a cake of soap under the top sheet, and it would stop that sort of thing. Well, she did, and it did. She hasn't had it since. And long later, I got this thing where my feet at night would begin to itch, and they keep me awake. I'd have to get up and walk around. So I tried the soap under my sheets, and it stops it. Now, is that my imagination and her imagination, or is there something beneficial to it?
Well, I don't really know. That is a described phenomenon, and I have had patients come in bringing me articles, and I've had patients that tried it, and it didn't seem to do any benefit. Actually, the yearly national sleep meeting was just recently, and at that presentation I was at, there was actually some discussion of that. There's been no scientific evidence for it. The theories are that maybe it has to do with the contact with the soap. Maybe certainly people with restless legs feel that leg massages can help them temporarily. Movement resolves the problem while you're moving, but it comes back as soon as you get still. There's even some theories that maybe something about the substance in the soap, sort of almost an aromatherapy, might have an effect. But science is looking at that, but doesn't have an answer for it. If it works for you, it certainly is a easy way to handle it. From a scientist's perspective, we have to be careful that, you know, you can do something and something else happens, and the two aren't related to each other, even though they may seem it. And so that's what's going to take some further evidence to actually see in all cases how we would expect it to function.
That's fascinating, the soap secret. Johnny in Shreveport is on hold. Johnny, go ahead with your question this evening.
I was wondering what's available locally as far as a take-home kind of monitor to see whether or not the CPAP is working.
Well, Johnny, there are several things that we do. There is an ability to look at oxygen with a home monitoring oxygen device. The problem is that you can have apnea and not have a lot of change in the oxygen, even bad apnea. And so that sometimes is difficult to determine. There are some portable monitoring devices that are actually becoming more effective. Most of them are not self-help devices. They take a laboratory that is experienced with use of those to be able to interpret it. And many of those don't include a monitor of actual sleep. So we may know whether the person had breathing trouble or not, but we don't know whether they were in various kinds of sleep and stages of sleep and so forth. So sometimes it gives an incomplete answer. But there are labs that have it, and we do have some of those devices or have access to it when it's appropriate to use it.
All right. Next caller is Chris from Keithville. Chris, what's your question for Dr. Chesson?
My husband does a lot of movement in the night in his sleep. He does have sleep apnea, but I wouldn't call this restless leg. It seems to be associated with dreams. He has very active dreams and, you know, does a lot of movement that's disturbing to me, you know, and I just wonder if there's any solution to that.
Sure. I frequently hear the experience that a patient's sleep problem and a solution to it is a disruption of two people's sleep or a solution for two people's sleep, and I believe that's actually true. There is a disorder where the normal paralysis in dreaming sleep does not occur or only occurs partially. And in those situations, people may act out dreams. It may be fragments of dreams, and so they just move around a little bit. It may be actually diving out of bed or you know, throwing something across the room or very active types of activities. Apnea will worsen a tendency for those disorders to occur by its sense of sleep fragmentation. Additionally, people who just have apnea will often move or do something restless at the end of the breathing pause when their body tends to try to wake them up to rescue them from not breathing. And so each of those will be accompanied by a movement. So it would take some careful history and perhaps some evaluation. And then once we know which of those disorders it is, then we can usually correct it.
We've got about 10 minutes or so left to this evening's program, Our Health Matters. I'm joined by Dr. Andrew Chesson, who's the founder of the LSU Health Science Center's Sleep Disorders Clinic. And still time to get your question in. Again, the number 800-552-8502. This time we have Chuck in Manny. Good evening to you, Chuck. Go ahead with your question.
Good evening. Thank you. And I haven't been able to listen to the whole program, so you may have answered this question already. But I've had a back injury for about 4 months, and I had gotten accustomed to taking a pain pill before I went to bed every night, and I haven't been doing that for about a couple of weeks, and I'm not 100% recovered from my injury, but I have a lot of trouble getting to sleep, almost like anxiety. It's like I can't relax. My body can't relax. I'm just very, very restless, and I really don't want to take medicine, or at least prescription medicine, to have to sleep. I mean, is there anything that I can do besides taking something that would help me be able to relax?
Sure.
Pain pills are a lot like sleeping pills, that sometimes more chronic use of them result in some tendency to withdraw. And withdrawal can cause problems with sleep. There's also kind of a phenomenon where you learn to sleep with a medicine, and then when you don't have it, you start having trouble, and that creates anxiety about not being able to get to sleep, and you get into a cycle that I sort of talked about earlier, where you sort of become programmed to do battle with trying to get to sleep, and that promotes more wakefulness. With some additional history detail, sometimes intermittent withdrawal can help, where you get off of the medicines for a day or two and then use it for a rescue so that you begin to sort of get back into good sleeping habits. Sometimes there's some features called sleep hygiene, where we sort of teach people about things to avoid and things to watch and things to prepare themselves for. That help them develop some sleeping patterns. And there are a number of self-help booklets that can give you some guidance about that, or you can call the lab and we'd be glad to send you some information.
For that matter, are there any good online resources for looking into this?
Yes, there are. We're getting ready to improve some of the stuff we're doing online with some links, and so that may be another few weeks or a month before it's available. There's the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, and they have a public component website for education, so they're often a good. I believe it's aasn.net.org, but I'm not absolutely certain of that. But if somebody Googles the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, they'll find that. There's also the National Sleep Foundation, NSF, and they have a public education site.
Okay, and what's the site at your center?
If they go to the LSU Health Sciences Center in Shreveport and go to the Department of Neurology. There's some connections there, and that will be more robust in the near future.
Okay. And our next caller, we have James in Kilgore. Go ahead with your question this evening.
I can't get enough sleep. I have sleep apnea. I have tried the CPAP. I've done blood work. Everything comes back fine. But no matter what I do, I cannot get enough sleep. And can't wake up. And if I have a whole bunch of coffee, I'm fine for a little bit, but then it goes back to falling asleep.
Well, I guess there would be a couple of questions. One is, having apnea doesn't keep you from having other sleep disorders. So one thing that we always have to be suspicious of is if we've tried to fix something and that we've fixed it and the symptoms are still there, maybe we didn't come up with the right diagnosis, or maybe there's another diagnosis that we need to consider. So that would be one thing. The other is people can use CPAP, but if it isn't titrated properly to fix their particular airway and their particular apnea, it may not be a full treatment. So that's a consideration that we have to look at carefully. CPAP is not a one thing fits all. We customize it to each individual person according to what they need to fix their airway. And then lastly, there are some additional medicines that now are FDA approved for treatment of residual sleepiness in people who have corrected sleep apnea. Now, I must emphasize that it's not a good idea to try to correct the sleepiness without correcting the apnea, because the cardiovascular consequences, the stroke, the heart attack risks still remain. But in people who have that's fully corrected, there are some potential other ways to treat residual excessive sleepiness. If you continue to have trouble waking during the night, I would raise the question of whether the apnea was fully treated or not.
Okay. We'll try to squeeze in just one more question here this evening because it's almost 7 o'clock. This is Harold in Nacogdoches. Go ahead with your question. Harold, go ahead.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah, you'll probably want to turn your radio down if you've got it turned up.
Okay, just a minute.
Well, while we're waiting, do you ever run into this with children? Oh, are you back? Okay, there we go. Harold, go ahead.
I'm Harold Hawley. I have the hypertension. You know, I've had high blood pressure since 81, and I toss and tumble a lot at night, and I try to get to sleep. I go to bed at about 10, and I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Well, hypertension sometimes ties in with sleep apnea. And we certainly, there's plenty of experience that's been nationally. If you take a hypertension clinic and screen it for apnea, you'll find a large number of apneics proportionate to what you'd expect for that population. So hypertension is a symptom of sleep apnea, even if people don't know that they have sleep apnea. So that would be a consideration that we'd need to address. Your earlier question about
I was going to ask, in treating kids, yeah. I mean, do kids come up with this? What do you do with
Absolutely.
Them?
We treat the full range of patients from newborn to octogenarians in the center, and we do use CPAP at times for children. More commonly in children, it's a structural anatomy. Tonsils, adenoids often will resolve the problem in children, and so that's sometimes helpful. There's now evidence of a crossover between ADHD, a hyperactivity, and apnea, where if you sort of think about it, the prototype of a fussy two-year-old that hasn't had their nap is they get restless and irritable and so forth. And so sometimes in children, the symptoms are not straightforward. And so we're beginning to change diagnoses in some kids that they've been treated for ADHD. They actually get a little better on stimulants because they're kept awake from the medicines, but the cardiovascular and other long-term consequences may actually be worse.
All right. Well, we're pretty much close to the end of our show here. Just about 1 minute left. I wanted to, again, thank you, Dr. Chesson, for coming and being with us this evening. And, of course, you're the founder of the LSU Health Science Center Sleep Disorders Clinic. If someone has a question, is there a number there where they can reach you?
Sure. They can call the medical school, 675-5365, which is the center at the LSU. All right. I appreciate being here, and I'm always glad to try to inform people about sleep and sleep disorders because it's a passion that I have.
Well, we've had a lot of callers, and next time we'll see if maybe we can get you back here, and because I still have a whole lot of questions that are left. Tonight's Health Matters has been produced by Renee Moran, engineered by Rick Shelton, with help from Wally Derleth. Remember, this program is for informational purposes only. It's always recommended that you see your physician with any medical questions. Again, my guest has been Dr. Andrew Chesson. I'm Kermit Poling. Thanks for joining us. This is member-supported Red River Radio, a public radio service of LSUS. You're tuned to KDAQ, Shreveport, Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado, and KLDN, Lufkin, Nacogdoches.